Thank you. Welcome to the customer panel for HA&TR. I'm Sanjay Mishra. I work in a team within SQL Server Product Org. My team is called SQL CAT. That's why you see the prefix there called SQL CAT. And as part of the CAT team, I work with some of the largest, biggest, most complex customer deployments. And I have the proof for that. The elite panel we have for the customers who have gone and deployed, who are some of the early adopters of Always On in SQL Server 2012. And they will speak here what they have deployed, what they have learned from these deployments, why they choose a particular solution, and what are the interesting things about their deployment. So I would like to first set the stage as we go. There are a few things to know. We assume that you have a prerequisites or some basic knowledge of Always On failover cluster instances and some basic knowledge of availability groups, because we have no time here. It's only 75-minute session. Each of these customers' presentation itself is a 75-minute session. We have compressed five of them into one. So we assume that you know the basics. If there are questions on the fundamentals of how this technology works, we'll be happy to take questions at the end or at the booth. So please keep that in mind. For the purpose of this presentation, we assume that high availability usually refers to local high availability within a data center. Sometimes people use these terms in an interchangeable way. And disaster recovery means an availability across data center. What do you do when your data center fails? So whenever we are using the word HA, that means we are talking about how do we provide local HA within a data center. Whenever we talk about DR, we are talking about how do we provide a availability across data centers. One more thing to note here is Always On is not equal to availability groups. How many of you think is this statement correct? And how many of you think this is incorrect? Thank you. Thank you. Always On is not equal to availability groups. Always On is an umbrella of all the SQL Server HA and DR features that were either newly introduced in SQL Server 2012, like availability groups, or significantly enhanced from previous releases, for example, failover cluster instances. So Always On is a set of failover cluster instances and availability groups. So if anybody is saying that I'm using Always On, that means they're using either or both of these technologies. And availability groups is not equal to database mirroring. And database mirroring has been there since SQL Server 2005 and has been enhanced over the releases, but has been declared deprecated as of SQL Server 2012. Declared deprecated means it is still there in SQL Server 2012. It will be there for a couple of releases, but it will not be further significantly enhanced. Our recommendation to use for similar functionality is to go use availability groups now onwards. And here is our panel. And we have five great customers with you here today. ESNET, ServiceView Corporation, Care Group, BWIN, Dot Party, and a hedge fund in Connecticut. They are so secretive about their fund that they don't want to name their company name. And you will get to see why. Each of them use a particular HA&TR solution pattern. If you attended my presentation on Monday evening, I talked about various design patterns, and we mostly have three design patterns. And one of them is using multi-site failover cluster instances for HA&TR. Another model is using availability groups for HA&TR. Another way is combining these two, for example, using failover cluster instances for HA and availability groups for DR. And there's various flavors of these customers have gone and deployed. As I mentioned, each of these customer presentations is itself a session or more, because there is a lot to talk about this presentation. But for your benefit, we have compressed them into one. So each of them will talk about 10 minutes about the presentation. And they'll be highlighting a couple of significant aspects of their deployment. And I would recommend that please hold your questions to the end. 10 minutes. So at the end, we will have minimum 10 minutes for Q&A. And the panel will be here after the presentation for some time, as well as in the booth. So you can come and talk to us and ask any further questions. With that, I Okay, there is one more handover, and this is what I just talked about. He says there is a lot more to these deployments than what we can present in 10 minutes for each. So please come by the booth. Okay, with this, I hand it over to Michael Steinicke from ESNET.
Thanks, Andre. So a little bit about EdgeNet. We are a leader in data services and guided selling market solutions. We provide software for retailers, both software as a service and software that they deploy in-house. We have customers like Home Depot, Lowe's. We host sites for Bing and Better Homes and Gardens and provide data for Google and Bing Shopping. We have quite a bit of data-centric applications, which is why we're using SQL Server and have the high availability needs. We have multi-site configuration, data centers in Milwaukee and Atlanta. We have an SLA of 99.99% annual uptime, and that's for applications as well as the database infrastructure. Our goal is to provide high availability and near real-time disaster recovery. We are running large SQL servers. Our hardware is 64-core and 80-core NEC servers. We're doing disk-based replication with EMC Recover Point and EMC SANS. So our primary data center is in Milwaukee, as you see here on the left side. And we have a Windows failover cluster node A, and that's our active SQL server. And the subnet, you'll notice, is a 10.10.10 subnet. So one of the new features in SQL Server 2012 Always On is the ability to do multi-subnet failover, so I no longer have to have a stretch VLAN between my data centers. My DR site in Atlanta, you see the Windows failover cluster node B, is in the subnet 10.11.11. So locally, in the Milwaukee data center, node A uses a local SAN. And with the EMC recover point, it's asynchronously replicating the disk in a write consistent manner between Milwaukee and Atlanta, which is about an 850-mile distance. To the disk on the Atlanta side, which is what the Windows failover cluster B node uses. So that's our basic failover cluster for DR. We actually also have multiple nodes at the primary site, but it gets kind of ugly on the diagram when you start putting that in there. We are also utilizing always-on availability groups at our primary site. So we have another node at the primary site, and you see on the red LUNs on here on the SAN as well. Those LUNs have the data put on them via always-on availability groups, not through hardware mirroring. That way we're able to have a readable secondary to offload our read-only workload from our reporting systems. We chose to use failover clustering instead of availability groups for our HA and DR solutions because our applications require MSDTC to do distributed transactions across multiple SQL Server instances, and you can't do that with any of the other high availability options within SQL Server. So that's it for mine. Go through the base again. It's three nodes. Two nodes at each data center, or one at each data center, 850 miles apart. One node at the primary data center for hosting the availability group. Four clustered SQL instances. One clustered MSDTC between them. We're replicating about 11 terabytes of usable storage. Multi-subnet, two. We're also running tempdb on local disk, which is also a new feature in SQL Server 2012. That saves us money and bandwidth on replicating that storage between our two data centers. So all that tempdb data, it's every time the instance starts, tempdb is rebuilt, so there's no reason to be replicating that data between the two sites. It also allows us to use solid-state storage for tempdb, so we're able to have a lot faster tempdb and reduce latency on that. Couple things to keep in mind. In the multi-subnet cluster, when you create one of these, failover clustering does something called register all providers, so it registers both IP addresses and DNS. This allows you to have the ability that when you have a failure from one subnet to the other, you don't have to wait for DNS updates. So you need to make sure that your client providers that are connecting to the SQL server have the connection string and support the multi-subnet failover equals true tag, and there's a link in the presentation to the MSDN article about that. There's also some interesting things when you're installing multi-subnet clusters. The install time is longer. When you install a SQL Server cluster, the installer checks all the nodes in the cluster, and the latency between those nodes affects that install time. So you want to make sure that you try to streamline that as much as possible and use the strip streaming functionality in the installer to put the right service packs and CUs on it when you start, so you don't have to go through that process multiple times. If you have a lot of nodes and have a lot of distance between your servers, as well as have a lot of LUNs, you can have times of over an hour just to install an instance. So with that, we'll bring on David Smith.
Thank you, Mike. I am the Director of Software Architecture at ServiceU Corporation. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about a little bit about our overriding architecture considerations, how we achieve the availability that we need for our SLAs, and then I'm going to talk to you about our specific deployment and some very important lessons that we learned during setup that hopefully will help you avoid some of the same issues. So talking about our environment, in terms of IT, we have three overriding goals. One, in no particular order, they are availability, security, and performance. In terms of availability, our SLA is 4 nines, but in our case, that includes both planned and unplanned downtime. So no matter what happens during the year, we have no maintenance windows, we have to be up, we can only be down for 52 minutes a year. In terms of security, we are a level one PCI service provider, so we have the strictest security standards in terms of PCI, and that always influences our decisions. It also means that for our DR facility, we have to have all of the PCI security standards in place before we're able to fail over to that data center. And then the third is obviously performance. We are a software as a solution service provider, so if people are going to use our system over the internet, our performance always has to be there and be solid. In terms of architecture, achieving uptime of only 52 minutes of downtime a year for real nines is very difficult. And as you work towards that goal or try to work beyond that goal, you'll see that every little bit counts. So there's several decision drivers in terms of our architecture that we always have to focus on. The first is every technology that we implement, whether it's at the application level or the database level, networking, whatever it is, needs to provide more uptime. Even if it's just a few seconds, if a few seconds a month, we get a few seconds a month of increased uptime due to a new technology, over the period of a year, that can amount to 1 or 2 minutes, which is really very significant in terms of our overall SLA. We also try to eliminate manual intervention. We want our system to be self-healing as much as possible. There are some times where a human needs to make a decision as to what the next action should be, but we try to eliminate single points of failure and manual intervention. The last two are kind of related. We always also try to keep it simple to make troubleshooting very easy. In the worst case scenario, you have a problem at 3 o'clock in the morning after the person that's on call has been up drinking all night, or whatever the case may be, it's the worst case scenario. We want, and the design pattern, as a general rule, should be keep it simple so that when those things happen, you can solve the issues very quickly. It's very easy to diagnose. So our approach to high availability is to have highly trained personnel, extensive monitoring, which I can't emphasize enough, good documentation, and then standardization across the enterprise. In terms of standardization, we go all the way to the IP level to say the IP addresses have a similar scheme between our dev environment, our DR environment, our production environment. So if you're familiar with one environment, you already know what the other environment looks like. It's already very familiar to you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk you through our SQL Server 2008 implementation, and then how we moved into SQL Server 2012 with the new features. So to give you just a brief overview of SQL Server 2005 or 2008 in our infrastructure, we have two data centers, one in Memphis, the one on the left, the other is in Atlanta on the right. There are about 500 miles, line miles, between the two cities, so we use asynchronous database mirroring between sites. Now, very key on this slide is that with database mirroring, we had two completely separate clusters, one in Memphis, one in Atlanta, and a SQL Server failover cluster instance at each location. One of the things that all of us here on stage learned very early on working with SQL 2012 and always on is that terminology is very key to being able to communicate all of these concepts. So during the presentation today, one of the things you should take away is hopefully new technology or new terminology. So we'll try and emphasize some of that as we go through the presentation. So Windows Server Failover Cluster, or WSFC, you'll see abbreviations on some slides. And the SQL Server Failover Cluster instance is a SQL Server clustered instance that lives on top of the Windows Server. So the key here is two Windows clusters, two SQL Server Failover Cluster instances. You notice that in our deployment, we have three nodes in each instance. This is a single instance on three nodes. The reason for that is we want to make sure that even in the case of a hardware failure on a single node, we're not in emergency mode. If we only had two nodes and one node failed, then at that point, we've got to get that other node up as quickly as possible, because if something does happen to the remaining node, we're completely down. That's not acceptable for us with our SLA. So we have an extra hardware node ready just in case there is a problem. So we're able to fail down. Another node fails. And you'll notice that underneath the nodes there on both sides, we're using a disk-only quorum. We are not using a majority model, because a majority model means that whatever the total number of nodes is divided by two have to be up in order for the cluster to be online. We want to fail down, and our business requirement is to be able to fail down to a single node with no user intervention and still be up. The technical term for that is last man standing. So you'll see last man standing in several presentations. That's the key concept that we needed with database mirroring and then moving into availability groups. One note about that is a disk-only quorum does provide some added benefits. The challenge there is you need to make sure that the quorum disk is fully protected, both at the RAID level and also within fault tolerance within your SAN or whatever your storage device is. You need to make sure that it's always available and that it's fully protected. So moving into availability groups with SQL Server 2012, you'll notice that the two boxes on each side now have a third box around them. The requirement for the deployment that we used, which is failover cluster instances plus an availability group, is that it be a single Windows cluster. That's a very big distinction between database mirroring and availability groups. So we've moved to a single Windows cluster that spans multiple sites. You'll see that we do still have asynchronous data movement between sites with the availability group. We do still have two completely independent SQL Server failover cluster instances. There's one at each site, but they're just part of one Windows Server failover cluster. The key to this is that we now, with Windows Server 2008, can support asymmetric storage. Previously, and if you're familiar with clustering, you may think this isn't a possible configuration. Your clustering team back home may tell you that this is not a possible configuration. Because previously, all nodes in the cluster had to see all the storage in order to be able to add them to the cluster. That's no longer the case. Some nodes can see some storage, other nodes can see other storage, asymmetric storage. So we still have a challenge because we want to have a disk-only quorum. We don't want to have a majority model. So a disk-only quorum is now, with some service packs with Windows Server 2008 and later, available. And we can have a disk-only quorum, even with asymmetric storage, between sites. This was a critical feature for us because our business requirement was last man standing. without this feature, we wouldn't be able to accomplish that. So we're thrilled that the Windows clustering team added support for it. A couple of, actually three different points about that. First, you cannot configure an asymmetric disk-only quorum with the GUI, and you cannot configure it with PowerShell in Windows Server 2008. You have to use cluster.exe. It does require thorough knowledge of clustering, and you need to do significant testing if you're going to do this type of implementation, because there is a lot to learn and to understand so that you know if anything goes wrong, what are your next steps. And then third, with a primary site loss, when we have to assume that the first site is no longer available, we need to force the quorum online at the second site and then go through the process of getting it online. We do have to move to a node majority model temporarily, and then we can move back to a disk-only model in the DR facility. We have to move to a node-only model to get the disk out of clustering, and then we can move back to a disk-only model. So I mentioned that there were several things that we discovered during setup that were very key. I want to mention a couple of those and hopefully save you hours of frustration and simplify your installation. If you're looking at an FCI plus AG configuration, which would be the scenario if you're moving from database mirroring into availability groups, then previously we could use the same instance name between sites. And in our case, we did for standardization. I talked about wanting to standardize things between all environments. That was possible before because at each site we had a separate Windows Server failover cluster. Now with availability groups, remember we have one cluster, so the instance names must be different for every instance. So we have one instance name, Insto1, DR-Insto1, whatever you want to call them, but they are separate instance names. That creates an additional challenge because for the data and log paths, we need to have the same path between sites. So it's a recommendation, it's not a requirement. The recommendation is to have the same file path between sites, because if you ever do a file operation, then the secondary will go into a recovering state because the path has to be available for that file. There are a lot of other considerations. The big thing I would say is make sure you plan, test thoroughly, and then break things and test again. Like I said, a lot of considerations, a lot of things that we went through for our environment, and if you'd like to come by the booth, we'll be more than happy to talk about your specific situation and how to implement your scenario. We'll also stay around for a while after this presentation. So next, we've got Care Group and Ayad to present some other interesting ideas.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Ayad Shamoud. For Care Group, and we'll share with you the SQL Server 2012 deployment. It's a different deployment than what we used to do in the past. We used to use physical boxes, failover cluster instances, and database mirroring. So, but I'm going to share some of the deployment.
Hello.
Yeah. Implementation with Hyper-V. So just who Care Group is? It's among top five. Large healthcare systems nationally. And it's a four hospitals located in Boston. One of the key points here in the slide is our HADR requirements. As we have patient care systems and mission critical applications, the databases has to be up and running 24/7 with zero downtime, zero data loss. And also we are ranked number one most innovative healthcare IT nationwide. A couple of months ago was in the Information Week. One other point here, actually, with the, what we did many years ago is, as we manage different groups of databases, and I mean different groups of applications, some of them are highly, mission-critical application has to be highly available, no data loss, no downtime at all. So we want to invest properly in the equipment, in the hardware, in the software. So what we did is we classified those applications as the criticality of these applications. So AAA means zero downtime, zero data loss. So we store them on a high-end servers, storage, and network, and invested in monitoring tools and supported 24/7. Majority of the databases are considered double A, so we are allowed for hour less downtime and data loss. But in the meantime, we implement the same HADR design for both AA and AAA. The exception is with AA is we trying to move those AA application databases to Hyper-V environment. The rest is our 1A, which basically we have selective HADR. Some of them still supported on clustering and database mirroring in the past, but some of them we do just as basic as backup store for recovery. So care group, the Hyper-V and live migration deployment. This is the pretty much the design of servers and requirements in the for the implementation. So each host in the Hyper-V equipped, equipped with the following cards. So as you see here, we have six network cards in each host, and I'm going to show you in the next slide the design. And for each network card, it's actually each NIC is dedicated for one feature in the Hyper-V. So for cluster management to manage the two hosts, we do that dedicated NIC. We have two heartbeats connection for a private one, private two. Live migration, I'm going to show you how live migration works, and we need that dedicated network card so we get like a fast live migration process. Guest virtual public network, and also dedicated backup network. Okay, and the two, just over here, sorry. The two machines are 64-bit, this 2008 R2 SP1. And we are required shared storage. We are an EMC storage shop, so it's all fiber channel. You have to install Hyper-V role and failover feature, cluster feature. So this is the design of the SQL 2012 in Hyper-V. Let's just focus on the top level here because it's a little bit of complexity, but it's a different level or layers of clustering. So if we want to focus at the top two nodes on the left and the right, node A and node B, those are the two main hosts in the cluster setup. And we have a cluster, it's a Windows host cluster, which allows us actually, if we hosted VMs in one node and we lose that node, it will fail over to the second node. So as we have here, that's the first Windows cluster for the two host, for the two Hyper-V hosts, node A, node B. And that provides us actually with hardware and OS failure protection. Second, because now we want to take advantage of always-on, we have always-on failover cluster instance and always-on high availability group. With the always-on failover cluster instance requires iSCSI storage in Hyper-V, and Care Group doesn't support iSCSI. So always-on availability group work around that limitation for us, and we'll be able to use fiber channel with non-shared disk. So now I have Denali A and Denali B as a two VMs in my setup, and that where we have a guest cluster. So we have a host cluster at the first layer. Now inside the Hyper-V, we have a second cluster, it's a second Windows cluster. And those two nodes and eventually the third node in the DR will be part of the guest cluster environment. So with that setup, now I will be able to go and install the, enable the always-on and create my availability group. So the first, and with that second guest cluster, Allah provide us with OS and SQL failure. Now SQL, it's actually, it's non-shared disk, so SQL services up and running on both nodes at the same time, the non-shared disk. So with this, we created the availability group, and in our case was a billing system. And then the left VM, which is Denali A, is a primary. And we created a sync replica, which is real-time synchronization, and that provides us zero data loss. So if we lose the primary, we can fail over automatically to the secondary, which is in this case Denali B. And we will set up actually async replica with DR just to provide high performance option for the application on the primary server. And that's also taken consideration the connection and the bandwidth between the main data center and the DR side. How many of you actually managing SQL in VM in general, VMware or Hyper-V? And Hyper-V specifically? Wow, just care group and you, thank you. So this is availability group provided us with disk and database failure. So if I lose or if I get corrupted database on the primary server, it will fail over the whole availability group. And just FYI, availability group can be one or multiple databases in that availability group. So in case of a failover, it will fail all the databases altogether. So if I lose the disk on Denali A, I have another instance, which is a Denali B replica, fail over all my databases safely. With the async replica, there is a chance of data loss. It depends on how much behind the synchronization. So let me share with you how the Hyper-V Lite migration works. And we tested it, and it works perfect for us. So again, if we want to focus on the data center only and focus on the two hosts, node A and node B, and again, I have a VM on the left, which is Denali A. I have another VM on the right, which is Denali B, with a sync a replica availability group between them. And as you see in the bottom, I have the disk, which is CSV. It's a cluster shared volume. And that's how you want to set up when you set up the Hyper-V, that disk will be accessible by the two hosts at any time. And that's how the storage team provided us with the storage pool. From there, we created VHD virtual hard drives and dedicated VHDs for each instance. So on the left, the Denali A has three VHDs, one for data, one for log, and one for TMDB. Same thing for Denali B. Now I want to do a live migration. With live migration, it doesn't really interrupt my application or my clients. Everybody stay connected. The application stay connected, and there's no interruption at all. So now I want to initiate a live migration. First thing it does is it copy the configuration data for that VM to the node B, which is the second host. Once the configuration data is there, it will create that VM space. And now, second, what it does is going to start doing the memory content copy. So we'll start copying the memory content from Denali A on the left side to the new Denali A on the right side. Then it does the memory sync. It syncs up the memory, and when it's 100% synchronized, it will just redirect the connection to the new VM without interrupting the clients or the application. So with that, and it will automatically, the Denali A is still connected to the VHDs because it's a cluster shared volume. With that, actually, it did really provide us high availability, no interruption in service, and it maintained the availability group sync between Denali A and Denali B without interruption. And on the left side now, I can take that host down for maintenance, for recovery, or whatever. Once I'm done, I'll do the same thing, live migration, go back. Just to share with you numbers here, we tested on a 32 gig memory instance, and it took about 6 minutes to do the live migration. Live migration is not high availability feature. It's designed for maintenance, and it's more a manual process. But in case I lose the host on the left unexpected crash, it will initiate an automatic failover for you. So just quick deployment consideration. Availability group is not database mirroring. You want to really understand what availability group is, how it works, because it's a kind of a new technology, new features, new management. Rethink about quorum model. As David mentioned, how the quorum model is different now and always on deployment. So you want to make sure you understand it very well. Once again, as a DBA, work closely with the server admin people or with the server team, because you depend on the server team design and implementation and management of your Hyper-V environment, cluster environment, Windows environment. And the same thing for Windows server team or server admin. They need to understand how always on works, how SQL, you know, integrated now with the cluster in Windows. Test and validate and pre-production. What we did is we left our production servers, set up a parallel environment, and we've been updating in sync and just run this for a month or two just to make sure nothing breaks. And our deployment, performance-wise, we almost same performance. Even moving from a physical box, database mirroring, clustering, to Hyper-V, always-on availability group, the performance almost the same. With that, I will hand the mic to Rick. Thank you.
Thanks, Hayat. So, does my mic work? Okay, sounds like it. So first, let me start with saying sorry. I'm not an American, so my English might suck. I hope you still understand me. I'll not to go too deep into what Bibin Party does, because we're an online gaming company, and this is apparently illegal in the US, so I'll skip that part. I'll talk today about one part of our system in particular. We use always-on and SQL servers for a lot of systems, and it's pretty much the same, but I'll focus on one. The system I'm talking about is where we handle our real money transactions, so all the credit cards, debit card processes that we do. It is also, for us, the authoritative system for all our responsible gaming issues, so meaning enforcing limits on players, so they against gambling addiction. And the system also includes a very specialized data warehouse, which is not an enterprise data warehouse, as you might know it, but only for this particular part of the company. We use multiple databases in this topology with multiple availability groups. In all the slides you'll see now, I will focus on one availability group. You can just multiply this up on the same servers. Really doesn't matter from the deployment perspective. We have four servers. One is particular for data warehouse. The other ones are hosting the availability groups in an active-active manner, meaning that workload is spread out over the four servers. Okay, what are our objectives with this? Jesus. Last year, we had availability of 99.99% overall, and this includes maintenance, pretty much as David has in his scenario as well. Recovery point objective is a very important thing for us. We have to run zero data loss no matter what. Recovery time is also fairly important, 10 seconds or less to get the system back online once we have a problem. And this is something normally nobody talks about. What is the worst case scenario we plan for? In our case, it's the loss of a complete data center. Including, we must still be able to do maintenance once we have lost one of our data centers. This also means, Sanjay pointed out in the beginning, that we're talking about HA in one data center and DR with another one. Well, we look at this a little different, but you will see. Oh, and one important point at the very end of this slide, the data warehouse is not included in the SLA because our management can obviously live with it if they don't get their reports for 20 minutes. Okay, so what did we do before Denali came out? Okay, now I'm back. We had database mirroring set up between our systems with one primary in one data center, the mirror in the other data center, used to witness in a third data center, where you see the difference to the others that for me. We use three data centers for this setup. And we used log shipping for our other two servers, including the data warehouse. The problem with this is when you have an outage of a server in the mirroring configuration, doing maintenance becomes tricky. Because when you look at this, if the mirror is gone or the principal is gone, and I start doing maintenance, I need to promote someone else to a new mirror first before I can start doing anything. Otherwise, I'll risk having an outage. Also, those of you that are familiar with database mirroring might notice if you have to have two databases always run on the same server, this is not easily doable with database mirroring. The third thing is we use log shipping to load the data warehouse server and use snapshots on top of this for the loading process. You can't apply new log backups while you have a snapshot on the database. So this means that we have to be very careful that snapshots don't get left over, otherwise we will run out of sync. And of course, one thing, this is just a minor thing, but pretty much a constant topic for errors, is you have to maintain mirroring connection strings with the failover attribute in all applications, otherwise you have a big problem. So with SQL 2012, we changed the setup a little bit. We put a Windows Server failover cluster over those four nodes and started introducing availability groups with two sync replicas and one async replica. What you can see here is that the primary is in one data center, the failover partner still is in the second data center, so we actually do have availability across data centers. I'll come to that point later on. The third thing is we replaced the witness from database mirroring with a file share witness in a third data center, which actually proved to be the biggest problem that we had in this whole deployment, because with a mirror, you don't need the same domain over the three servers, and we did not have the domain in the third data center, so setting this up was quite a challenge for us. The key points of the deployment: quorum model is now node and file share majority, so that even if we lose a data center, we're still online without intervention. Each node has a vote. We have the file share in the third data center and automatic failover between data centers. The reason for this is with availability groups right now, you can only have one automatic failover node, and we wanted to make sure that we stay online even if we lose a data center and don't have to have manual intervention at that point. What does our hardware setup look like? We use four socket machines, 32 processors, 256 gig of RAM, multiple 1 gigabyte NICs. The point I'm bringing this slide is the question sometimes comes up why we don't use failover cluster instances like some others do. The answer for this is in the last line on the slide. We use solid state devices, this is these nice slot cards you put into your PCI Express slots, for our transaction log files, because this is the only thing that is fast enough to keep up with our workload. And you can't do this when you try to have a failover cluster instance, because in a failover cluster instance, the transaction log obviously has to be on the SAN. So what did we gain by changing this? Faster failover time, incredibly but true. The availability groups proved to be quite faster in failover than database mirroring was. Maintenance is now easy in the failure condition, because the only thing you really have to change is which server is the automatic failover partner, which is a non-intrusive change into the availability group. We reduced the system load on the primaries with backup offloading, which is also a nice feature of availability groups, so we're doing all our backups, including log backups from the secondary. We're using read-only routing now, meaning that read-only queries can also be done from a secondary if you have to. And we enhanced the stability of the data warehouse by removing the risk of getting out of sync due to snapshots and log shipping. Some considerations you have to make when you do this migration, and I know I'm running low on time. In database mirroring, you're on your own. The DBAs can do this stuff and nobody cares. Now you have a Windows cluster involved. So in most companies, even bigger companies, you have to run with a Windows Server team below them. You have to need the Active Directory guys involved and stuff like that. And it's pretty hard, because most of the clustering guys and the Windows guys don't understand clusters that don't involve SANs. For them, normally a cluster resource always has a shared storage behind. A big challenge for us is that you can't have different OS versions anymore. Mirroring doesn't care. You can run different OS versions, you can run different SQL versions. With always on, you need a Windows cluster, and the Windows cluster only runs when all nodes are in the same Windows version. And all machines need to be in the same Active Directory domain. I mentioned this before, that we had a little problem with the one machine that was outside in the third data center. Some considerations after you did the migration: monitoring of an availability group is a hell lot different than it is in mirroring. You have to watch more components, you have more complexity, you have more things to take care about. And you need to improve the DBA skill set, because troubleshooting an availability group also is way more than troubleshooting mirroring. You have more components involved, you have more teams involved, you have more people involved, which means when you have a problem at 3 a.m., you maybe have a problem. So you have to pick up your communication, you have to make sure that all the teams work together and understand what you're doing, otherwise you might run into a problem later on. Okay. I'm barely on time, so I hand it over to Thomas.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. My name is Thomas Grosser. I used to work for the same company as Rick. I decided this illegal gambling is not so much for me anymore, and I moved on to the financial industry in the US, and now I cannot say for which company I work for. So let's get started. Let's set the stage a little bit for the requirements that I have. My recovery time objective and my recovery point objective should be close to zero. I mean, ideally, everybody wants zero and zero and failover in no time, but realistically, it can be close to zero. I have about 1,000+ databases in about 200 availability groups on about 100 and a little bit more than 100 servers. And all the servers are virtual machines, so I don't have the big machines as before. My two biggest challenges are, two biggest challenges are, I have very high security, so the DBAs cannot access the database machines. So everything has to be fully automatic. The time it takes us to get to a machine would be way too long to achieve these goals. And the second one is, I have to be resilient against failure of two independent components. So in theory, a whole data center plus another server in the DR side can fail. This is the setup that I had to find a solution for. Starting in SQL Server 2008, it was mirroring to the maximum. Data center A has the primary database. Data center B was mirrored. We used the witness with automatic failover into the other data center. So again, for us, HA and DR is basically the same. Yeah. We have another site where we have called last resort. So if both of these data centers fail, there's still some data somewhere. We had a file share that was spanned across the two data centers and replicated the data between it for the transaction log backups. The transaction log backups were restored immediately to two more machines on each side. If one of the primary machines in data center A or the mirror in data center B would fail, the log shipper would immediately by script promote it to take the role and take over. In addition to that, we replicated most of the databases to the other machine, to the secondary machines. This was not so much for high availability. This was more to use the resources on these machines. And we have most of these ugly applications that do OLTP and reporting on the same database. So we pointed the reporting queries to the replicas. And in addition to this, we had in each data center delayed log shippings, meaning we applied the logs about an hour later, then we took the backups in case some human error or some data was lost or corrupted, so we could immediately copy back the data from these machines. Okay, so what changed when we go to 2012? First, we had to remove a lot of stuff that we do not need anymore in SQL 2012. We don't need the replicas anymore because we can use readable secondaries. We don't need the log shipping anymore because we can now have multiple replicas within availability groups. We don't need a SQL Server witness anymore in the cert data center. And we don't need the file share anymore because we can use some nice trick. So, the first thing is, in the cert data center, we replaced the witness with a file share that then the cluster will use to make the quorum decision which data center to run. The whole unit became the availability, the Windows cluster that the availability groups will run on. We used another synchronous copy or synchronous replica in the primary data center. And the third replica has to be asynchronous because SQL 2012 only supports two synchronous copies, goes to data center B. As soon as any of these fails, the fourth copy immediately gets promoted automatically to be synchronous again. And for example, if the automatic failover secondary replica goes offline, the green one below it, that is called ASR. By the way, there's a hidden slide in the deck that explains all these three-letter acronyms. So when you look at it later, you can see that. Would immediately be promoted to be the automatic failover. To store our transaction log files, we use actually a second availability group and a second cluster running availability group in it and using file table to store the transaction log files inside SQL Server in a different one because the replication between the data centers is more smoothly. And we still do the delayed log shipping afterwards. The only thing we cannot handle with always-on and availability groups is our replication distributors. And we still need this replication between multiple of these servers. So for that, we had to come up with a different solution. In Data Center 1, we have our distribution databases on a separate server. This server is running a local high availability failover clustering, standard Windows cluster. So if one node fails, it uses the other node. If both nodes fails or the whole data center fails, the whole storage is replicated with storage replication to the other data center. And if the data center fails, the system comes on the other side. Okay. That's the legend. It should be hidden, but okay. And back to Sanjay.
Thanks. Thanks everyone for finishing right on time. And as I say, there is much more to each of these deployments than we could cover in 10 minutes for each. And we have 15, 20 minutes to take your questions. We intentionally compress things so that we can take as many questions from you as we can. So now the panel is open. Please shoot your questions. Yes. The cluster on Hyper-V. The question is, and what is the question?
Why have clustering on top of Hyper-V or VM? Why would you do that?
Okay, why do you have cluster on Hyper-V?
For live migration, you want to cluster the two hosts, the node A, node B, so I can do live migration from one host to another. I can't hear you.
Can you
come to the mic?
Yeah. I got the question. So to use Auzon availability groups or Auzon failover clustering, the servers need to be in a Windows failover cluster.
So if I have two VMs that I want to use an availability group in, they need to be clustered together. So you're going to need to do guest clustering to do that.
So before 2012, then the cluster on VM wouldn't be make as much sense, right?
If you need the live migration capability between two hosts, you need the Windows cluster for the Hyper-V host. Mm-hmm. But going down to the next layer here, which is the guest cluster, that's a requirement for always-on. So always-on requires Windows cluster. Since we are virtualizing the SQL instances, we have two VMs. The two VMs will be part of a second Windows cluster, which is in our case called a guest cluster. So the top one here, five.
Just to articulate that in a simple way, there are two levels of clustering. Mm-hmm. Level one is the host, that two hosts are clustered, mm-hmm. and the hosts are clustered to enable live migration. Mm-hmm. And live migration enables almost zero downtime maintenance of the host. Mm-hmm. There is second level of clustering on the guest, which is a virtual machine. And that level of clustering of the virtual machines is created to be able to enable availability groups.
Okay.
So that you can, from the SQL Server level, you can use that clustering of the virtual machines, because SQL is running on the virtual machines, and those virtual machines are clustered at the Windows level to allow a creation of an availability group. So in case the virtual machine is to be moved or any kind of planned or unplanned maintenance, another level of failover can be obtained. So there are two levels of clustering.
So in other words, in 2012, now it makes sense, such an architecture, but before then, having cluster on VM, you don't have much of bang for the buck, right?
So that's a good question. So 2012 and clustering on VMs, the clustering of Hyper-V VMs, if you wanted to use a shared storage of the virtual machines, then you need a iSCSI, not a SAN storage. This is still the case. Mm-hmm. In SQL Server 2012, because of availability groups, you can have non-shared storage Windows cluster to provide SQL Server high availability and TR. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
What is the network bandwidth between those two sites?
What is the network bandwidth between the two sites?
It's 1 gig connection between the two sites. And even the internal network bandwidth between the two hosts and the VMs are 1 gig connection. Yeah, well, we do have a few hundred gigs database size, so the transaction is not really highly transactional databases. It's high enough for us, but so far we don't have any latency. In some other, like terabytes databases with thousands of transactions per second, you may want to consider like a bigger connection.
And if you notice that between the two data centers, it is asynchronous. Yes.
Can one of you explain your process for testing your DR sites when you have the multi-site clustering? How do you do your DR testing?
Multi-site clustering, you want to take that?
That sounds like it.
I'll take that one and start out and see if anyone has anything to add. So there's two forms of testing. The first form of testing is a planned failover, where I can do everything at my leisure and I don't have to break my setup. The way that our system works normally is, if you envision the web servers, the application servers at each level, and then the database servers behind it with the availability group, our web servers at each location can talk back to the active database server. So over here or over here, we're constantly doing monitoring. So literally every second, I've got some monitoring that's going on, and I know whether or not there's a problem with the servers. So that's at the application level. I know that everything is ready to go. At the database level, when I do a failover, if I do a planned failover, then I can convert everything, go from asynchronous to asynchronous mode. I can reverse the roles on the availability group so that now my primary is at the DR center, and I can do all the testing that I want, make sure that everything works. My scenario is that the first data center just disappeared. It went black. I don't know why. I have no communication. It's off-site. I don't have anybody there. So the second form of testing is I've got to actually break the availability group, force everything online, and go through that scenario. That one is a little bit more complex in that it requires me to completely break everything and reseed the database, but we have some code that we've written where if we ever have to force a failover like that, it increments identity columns, it saves the current value, the new value, increments identity columns, and so we can go through a failover that way with no data loss. So it just depends on which level of testing you want to do, but that's how we accomplish it.
Okay. When you do the planned one, are you worried about performance, being that it's at a data center that's farther away from your primary data center?
It's a good question. The question is, am I worried about performance? If my clients are still connecting to the primary data center for the application, but connecting to the DR data center for the database, there will be some additional latency, but we're going to do this off hours, off peak hours anyway.
Okay.
I have the ability to control which data center my customers go to through a DNS-based solution and a low TTL. So in my case, I do the complete failover and I force my clients to the other data center as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you explain how you maintain schedule maintenance either due to Windows patching or SQL patching for the primary guest host?
I think this question applies to everybody, so each one of us.
I can answer how we do it. If we go back to, this slide. We always patch the passive side to the newest level available. When we reach a point where it's necessary to patch the primary side, we fail over. So what we basically do is we run 1 month in data center A, next month in data center B. This is also a very good DR test every month that everything works. So we basically, the passive data center gets patched nicely, and then once a month we fail over to the other one and reverse the process.
Does it impact your SLA agreement due to this maintenance?
I did not understand that, sorry.
Does it count against your SLA for this scheduled maintenance? I mean, there should be a one downtime, right, whenever you do
is
the...
Is it included in your SLA? Is the planned maintenance?
These planned failovers are over. I'm lucky. Financial industry does not work on the weekend, so we can fail over.
Okay. So I heard there are about 99.9 availability customers we had. So
can I did not say that. I said close to zero.
Some of the other group I heard.
So in my case, we have the four nines of availability. There's two types of patching. If it's just a OS patch or a hot fix or something like that for the OS, we'll patch the passive nodes at the local site. And then we'll do a failover off-peak hours, but that absolutely counts as part of that 52 minutes a year. Okay. So we have done everything that we can to lower that threshold so that we can failover quickly. One other thing to look at related to that with SQL Server 2012 is indirect checkpoints, so you can lower your failover time some.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And to add to your question, because you asked about schedule maintenance, how do you do index maintenance or index table stuff to keep up with uptime, because that is also part of your schedule.
Right. So that's actually a great point. My microphone's coming in and out. Okay, I'm back. It's a great point, schedule maintenance, index rebuilds. Whenever you're looking at mirroring or availability groups and you're pushing data to a different data center, you have to be very careful about when you're doing index rebuilds so that we have a low recovery point objective. We go through and we look at every index. When we do our scheduled jobs, we decide based on the fragmentation whether we do anything, whether we reorganize, or heaven forbid, have to re-index. So we're very careful and selective about when we do those jobs. We also, starting with 2008, we had the ability to do online index operations, right? Or 2005.
And we added more in SQL 2012.
Yeah. And with 2012, with our environment, we can actually rebuild all of our indexes online. So we don't actually have to take a table offline while it's rebuilding. We can do that all online. You cannot do that with XML data types and with a couple of deprecated data types, but with everything else, with lob data, you can actually rebuild it online.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes. Can you please use the mic?
This question is to Michael. Actually, I saw they're doing 850 miles offsite FCA cluster. So, and you are having around 11 terabyte of data for the replication. I know it depends on the transactional intensity of database, but are you guys facing latency?
So the latency.
So the question is, am I experiencing latency? Do you mean latency from the client to the SQL Server, or latency in the transactions committed for consistency on both sides?
Transaction committed.
So yes, there is a possibility of data loss in the event of a primary data site failure, because it is asynchronous. That latency with the recover point appliances, they do compression and block level replication. So even during high normal user load in our system, we're only seeing about 10 to 15 seconds out of sync from the primary to the secondary. The big times when we see a more than 15-second load is when we're doing major data loads to a system. If we're reloading a lot of data into a system, a major bulk load or something like that, then it's just the nature of
you're putting a lot of data in, a lot of data has to replicate. But for normal transactions, it's very low.
Thank you.
One question I have is, I saw the guest clustering, right? And I just wanted to ask, across the data center, is the heartbeat still going on the guest clustering in order to make it sure it's up?
So the question again on the guest clustering.
The question is, do you have a guest clustering going across data centers?
Yes.
So are the clustering heartbeats going around across the data center? Is that the correct one? Okay.
Yeah, with the guest clustering, it's the same setup as you set up Windows cluster. So it's the same Windows cluster, but I have the three VMs participated. The third VM and the DR is a different subnet. So, and you have that failover capability between the three.
And since it's a Windows cluster, yes, heartbeat has to go through across data centers. Cluster communication has to happen across data centers.
Yes.
But isn't it a lot of traffic between the across data centers, or that's not a concern?
Can you repeat it, please?
The traffic, the heartbeat traffic that is going across data center, is that a concern? Because I know in the past, we've been always considering that.
Okay. Would you like to?
Okay. So it's actually a great question. And I'll be more than willing to discuss it in detail with you afterwards if you're interested. Cross data center traffic, this is a great question. There are two settings in Windows clustering that you need to be very familiar with. One is the subnet threshold and the subnet delay. So there's a local subnet threshold or local threshold and then across subnet. The delay is going to be how many seconds or how many milliseconds it's going to attempt that traffic. The delay is how many failures you can have before it causes a failover, or the threshold, I'm sorry. So if you have a single cluster between sites, locally within each data center, they're going to use the same subnet delay, which typically the default value is 1,000 milliseconds. So every second, it's going to attempt a heartbeat. The cross subnet threshold is only going to apply to nodes that do not share all of the same interfaces with the other nodes. So essentially what that means is it's going to be the nodes at the other data center or the nodes on the other subnet. So you can set the two values, and locally you can have a very small delay, 1,000 milliseconds, and set it to 4,000 milliseconds or something across data centers. And then you can also change your threshold so that you don't have problems with failover caused by that. But it's a very good question. There's really a lot to think about there and configure. You can look for the defaults if that works for your environment, but if it's causing you problems and you see it in the cluster log, then you may need to adjust those values a little bit.
And by the way, the cross data center clustering applies to all the deployments here. Some customers have data centers close by, so they have a better luxury of a better bandwidth or small low latency. Some customers like Care Group and, some customers like ServiceU and Ezenet, they have data centers too far apart. But still they're able to work this out to manage a cross data center clustering.
And one more question on that you mentioned. So those thresholds you set up, configure in the clustering configuration when you have a cross data center? Okay, thanks.
Yes. You can use cluster.exe or PowerShell to set those settings.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, you'll go ahead.
Let me add something to this thing. We also looked at the overhead that we have with cross-site cluster. The thing we saw is, we're running 2,000 batches a second, even in off times, that the heartbeat delays and the heartbeat times are really minimal compared to what you transfer on data when you replicate databases across data center. It's, in our case, it's below 1 promille of the traffic we actually do across data center.
Thank you.
You're
right, Mark?
I'm going to add just one more very quick point to that. If you, for compliance purposes, have to log all of your traffic, the heartbeats actually happen from every interface to every other interface, to every node. So it's very, very small packets. It's not going to cause you any data latency because of it, but there's a lot of communication that's happening. So if you have to log that for compliance purposes, you need to decide how to configure your architecture to support that. In our case, we have to log all the traffic, so we've had to go through several different steps in the way that we've set up our public and private networks to minimize that traffic.
Yeah. One last thing. The Heartbeat, actually, it's a separate network connection from the public and the other network. So that's, again, will separate the communication between the Heartbeat private networks and the public between the application and backend database.
Mike, would you like to add something? You have 850 miles across two sites.
The other thing to keep in mind is that even though if you have a private network, if the private network can't be accessible, the Windows Failover clustering will try all of the networks available on the machine unless you've specifically disabled that.
Thank you. Any more questions? Anything that you would like to know that we did not talk about? Anything you would like to know about the product or the features? Anything you would like to know about the lessons they learned through these deployments? Good. Oh, yes, you have a question. So the good question. The question is there a specific need for a separate network for Heartbeat? There is no explicit need for that because cluster can communicate and all networks in the visible. But a lot of customers continue the best practices from the previous releases and ensure that they have enough redundancy on the network cards for all the communications. Yeah, you can have hardware redundancy in one network and then achieve that. It depends on how you want to configure it because a lot of people have different subnets on which they want to communicate. A lot of people have firewalls between different networks. And so there are further details to be worked out. But you can choose if you want to. You cannot. You have the option of not to.
So. Sanjay? Yeah. Can I add something just very small to that?
Yeah.
There are two overriding principles with Windows clustering, whether it's 2003 or 2008 or moving forward. Resiliency and quality of service. You need the resiliency to make sure that no matter what happens, that your cluster still knows what's happening with the other nodes. So somehow you've still got to provide that. Whether it's a single network adapter or multiple network adapters, you need the resiliency. If you're only using one network adapter, you also still have to provide quality of service, meaning that the cluster traffic has to have prioritization. Because if you're doing a file copy or something that's taking up all the bandwidth and your cluster can't communicate, again, you still have the same problem and it may cause a failover when there isn't really an issue. So those are the two overriding principles. The easiest way to do that is still with two network cards for simplicity. There's a lot of ways you can accomplish it, but as long as you achieve those two objectives, resiliency and quality of service, then you've satisfied the clustering requirements.
Okay. Thank you very much. We encourage you to fill in the evaluation form, and your feedback is very, very important and useful to us. And we'll all be in the booth in the technical learning area downstairs. Please come by the SQL Server booth, and we'll be happy to whiteboard anything, any architecture, any design discussions, any other thing, any further questions you may have. Thank you very much.